I became enormously patriotic when I was away. In fact, the pull of the country was so strong that I realized that I had to come back and, if possible, do some pioneering work there, and that's what that was my ambition.
If your grandfather settled in a community and your mother was born there and you yourself, through a coincidence, happened to be born in Germany, the base is still very much an Irish one.
My mother's father was organist of the cathedral in Cork since 1890, and my mother, his daughter, was a talented pianist and went to Munich to study there with a famous pianist named Stavenhagen. While there, she met my father, who was a student of Rheinberger. They married, and in 1906, Pope Pius X introduced his famous motu proprio, which banned women from church choirs. Now, my grandfather had built up a very fine choir in the cathedral, and he was so furious on discovering that it had to be eliminated that he went off to America in high dudgeon, and my mother then persuaded my father to come over to succeed him. The astonishing thing is that before he came to Ireland, he was organist in a small place called Dachau, of ill repute, unfortunately, but actually it was an artist's colony. And my father succeeded him as organist in Dachau. He went to Cork, and my father succeeded him as organist in Cork. Most extraordinary coincidence.
Ruth Fleischmann, the oldest of five Fleischmann children. Like my sisters and brothers, we went to school in Cork and studied here, and I left when I was 21, I think. I got a studentship, travelling studentship, to study in Germany. And now I retired 2 years ago, and I am looking forward to spending the rest of my years acting as family chronicler, I suppose one could say, for the achievements and the work done by my immigrant German musician family to the cultural life of Cork.
Conas a hála seisio, ní bhíon tara dál a héad gan an síl a cúr ar dúis, agus bé an síl ná an scéim a boníag ag cúiste garamidachis gúndé corcí, namely an óhín.
I studied for 2 years in Munich, and some friends of mine wanted me to stay on, but the pull homewards was much too strong. Like Sean O'Riordan in his time, the Dingle Peninsula was my idea of utopia. And when I was a youngster, I spoke Irish fairly fluently, and I adopted the pen name of Muirish O'Ronoin because I felt my own name was too anachronistic. And I set Irish texts, and I even went so far as to put Irish tempo marks and dynamics in a piano suite which was published by Chester in London, and that was thought completely daft, even though I did, I think, put Italian markings in brackets after the Irish. But that was going a bit far, I must say.
My name is Seamus DeBarra, and my association with Alois Fleischmann goes back to 1975, when I became a student in the music department in UCC.
Well, I started as a child. I mean, my mother has treasured all my early tootlings on the piano. I think I had done a movement of a string quartet and some songs before I went to Munich. I remember showing these to Sir Ronald Bax when he came, and he was very polite about them. And when in Munich, I wrote a piano suite which was published shortly afterwards by Chester, and which Charles Lynch recorded in fairly recent years.
Piano suite is the first mature work in which this authentic voice and an individual style is actually to be heard. And that style is very much bound up with the shape and contours of Irish folk music. The manuscript of the piano suite is unfortunately missing. The score was incidentally seen by E.J. Moran in Chester's showrooms, apparently, and Fleischmann published this piece under a pseudonym, Mirish O'Ronoin. He believed, I think, when he came back to Cork, and especially when he had this object of creating a Gaelic art music, that perhaps he might be taken more objectively if he sounded more Irish, like more of an Irish person than Fleischmann. I think there was a feeling that if he was a German, how could he possibly be writing Irish music? And he wanted to, I think, forestall criticism on that basis and present the music first under this pseudonym so that it would be assessed on its own merits.
Started off when he became professor in 1934, those schools which had music were not obliged to employ qualified teachers. Anybody would do. So he realised that the reason why he was the third graduate that UCC produced in music since 1906 was because there were no jobs. So he started lobbying the department, which of course took decades to have any impact at all, and he started off then talking to individual heads of orders to try and persuade them to send one or two members of the order to study music, and some of them agreed to do that. So gradually he built up a nucleus of properly qualified music teachers, academically qualified music teachers.
He was, I have to say, very good fun. As a professor, he managed to make doing the BMUS course under him a highly enjoyable experience. It gave them a thorough grounding in all the technicalities of music. Fleischmann was a firm believer that students really needed to have a very firm grasp of the essentials of compositional technique. So there was considerable emphasis on what was broken down into the subjects, the traditional subjects of harmony, counterpoint, form, orchestration, and so on, together with history courses, courses in analysis, and so on.
So my first problem was to find a habitat in the college, and we were given a small room in the observatory. And there, if you please, while attempting to lecture, you had from the men's club the sound of Ben's raucous singing. From the women's club, you had Salome music emerging on the piano, and I was trying to teach counterpoint with both these strains going on simultaneously. So anyhow, on the strength of it, of the impossible situation, we got quite a large room then, and from then on, as the classes grew, we went from place to place until finally we got a whole department on the Western Road. And it was quite a big house, and then I got 12 practice rooms added on for the students.
We sang all the counterpoint exercises in the class. We had to sit as an SATB choir, in fact, in the classroom, which he considered to be highly appropriate for a music department. And when we did counterpoint exercises, we sang them. When we did conducting, we sang for the student who conducted. We sang motets, 16th century motets, which the victim of the day would have to stand up and give us our pitches and conduct things. So, you know, there was a lot of SATB stuff that we used to do in the classroom. And he would illustrate at the piano when he was teaching harmony. He would play the examples and so on. But for the history courses, obviously, if he was playing something, a Bach symphony or a piece by Boulez or somebody like that, he'd obviously play a recording.
I'm Kitty Buckley. I'm music librarian in Cork City Library. And I was a pupil of Eloise Fleischmann. Secondly, he was a member of the library. Thirdly, he was our advocate in times of need during the last recession. And like all his students, I had great time for him, you know. I don't know of any student who didn't have, because he treated everyone so fairly. It's something you remember for the rest of your life.
Well, I think it was a sense of mission, if you like, in the cause of the arts. And my father felt that there was that every child has an innate creativity, and he hoped to set up a structure which would give all children, regardless of their family's wealth, access to the arts and to music in his particular case.
He was trying to build up the department, and he was willing to accept everybody who was interested, and he went out of his way to accommodate anyone who had an interest in music at whatever level, even if it was just a subject in arts, that was quite acceptable to him. And he also made provision for anybody who was working that the degree was combined in such a way that the lectures would start at 4 o'clock, say, in the evening, so that people who were teaching could do a degree after hours. He really did everything to accommodate everyone, you know, because he obviously wanted to build up the numbers of teachers in the country.
When Fleischmann set up the degree course, apart from the Cork Corporation funded lectureship in Irish music, he taught everything himself. There was no other staff until probably the end of the 1960s, the beginning of the 1970s. That meant he had to be extremely versatile and prepare these courses in areas which weren't specialist areas for him, but which were usually extremely interesting. So he taught early music and 20th century music as a general rule.
Every year would know every year in the music department. It was not just your year, it was the whole faculty kind of gelled together. And people used to help one another. If you had difficulty with harmony or that now at the piano or anything, there were practice rooms there, so there was always somebody who could help you. You know, somebody who knew better. Mihal O'Sullivan now used to help us regularly because, you know, harmony just came naturally to him, you know.
Because you had O'Riordan's laid-back Irishness, informality, easygoing kind of a thing. And then you had Fleischmann's Germanic, very definitely Germanic, approach to organisation, timetabling, punctuality, deadlines for handing up exercises, and even more deadlines for handing them back. And for 4 years, he never missed one deadline for handing them back. And we learned not to miss a deadline for handing them up. And I happen to like what he, even though he himself was also a musicologist, his main thing was as a composer. So the course he had designed was very hands-on, very applied, very practical. It was harmony and counterpoint constantly. It was a three-year programme. I stayed on for an extra year with him to do a taught master's programme so that I could get more of this.
Professor Fleischmann was very much a teacher. He supervised people and he insisted that you did things and he kept roles. If you were to be performing in masses or to go to seminars, he actually kept a roll of people. So it was kind of a nice progression from school where you were probably over-supervised and, you know, the anonymity of college wasn't there because he was a fatherly type of person as well. Then he looked after people.
What he liked about what I was doing, of course, is that I tended to be good at this compositional writing. Now, you know, it's actually compositional technique. It's not original composition. And he was brilliant at teaching it. I mean, we were getting a 19th century Germanic classical training in the 1970s here, 1970s in Cork. It was amazing.
My aim was to make it a useful course for the work which most of the graduates would be doing, namely schoolwork, because I suppose 75% of the students, if not more, got full-time jobs in schools. When I started, there was hardly any music in the schools. And by the time I'd finished, I suppose, we must have supplied 400 or 500 graduates all over the country. And I think it has made a big difference. I suppose I did more outside the college than I did inside the college. I must say it was very heavy work because I had carried the course myself in these years. And on top of that, I started the symphony orchestra.
Harmony countermined orchestration, including learning how to conduct, including physically getting up in front of the Cork Symphony Orchestra as a student, as part of your exam, and conducting your own orchestration of maybe a piece of piano music. In my case, I asked his permission, could I conduct one of my own pieces, because I was starting to compose at the time, in quite what I describe, quite an illiterate way.
Sure that his music students got an all-round training. They all studied voice production. They all had to arrange and compose, and their works were performed by the Cork Symphony Orchestra at the annual concert. So that when they went out, he wanted people who would be competent to teach in schools and from a variety of levels, and also who could play a role in the community, could start choirs, who could start festivals, and who would bring, as one of them once put it to me, the great joy of music could bring that back to the children and to the people that they had in the communities that they had come from.
But in the 20s, when Fleischmann was still a schoolboy, he used to go to Corkery's house, and there he would have met Frank O'Connor, who would have been a regular visitor, and O'Fallon. There is an interesting correspondence in the 1940s, late 1940s, when O'Fallon had apparently asked Fleischmann about music for a programme he was making on Cork for the BBC. Fleischmann's letter runs as follows. I suppose you know that the broadcast aroused intense resentment amongst Corkonians generally. Take, for instance, your reference to our college as fourth rate. Objectively speaking, the reference flattered us. If the greatest of the continental universities be taken as first rate, we would probably come in the 10th or 11th rate category, ahead of only some of the American and colonial colleges. But to refer to a body as fourth rate implies that it should be first rate and isn't, or that it thinks it is first rate and isn't. In both cases, the implication is unjust. A small college set in a relatively poor and uneducated agricultural community, lacking in grants and endowments, with a spoilt and twisted tradition from godless ascendancy college via hyper-nationalism to hyper-religiosity, we cannot hope to be more than a little better than what we are, nor are any of us under any illusions as to the deficiencies of our setup.
We had great difficulty in making the orchestra viable in the college, because very often there were more performers in the hall than audience. And so I started the Cork Orchestral Society to float concerts by the orchestra in the city. And that gradually grew then to a society that used to arrange up to a dozen recitals and performances in the year. Unfortunately, the war broke out then, and we had to stop for a few years, but it kept going. We started again immediately the war was over. During the silent film era, you had small orchestras in most of the cinemas, and some of these were very experienced. Some of these had come from England, actually. They formed the nucleus of my orchestra, and I had practically all the wind would drive from the local army band.
Yes, The Humours of Carolyn is a very interesting piece. The suite is very interesting from a number of points of view, because humours, the word humours, you know, refers to a medical term from the Middle Ages. Galen refers to this, these humours, which give rise to the four temperaments. And there are four movements in the Carolyn suite, and each one of these movements appears to correspond to one of the four temperaments. You have the finale, which is entitled Carolyn's Quarrel with the Landlady, which is the choleric. You have the melancholic, which is the Lament for Elizabeth MacDermot Roe, and so on. Now, he wasn't the first to do this. You have, of course, Nielsen's Second Symphony and Hindemith's The Four Temperaments for Strings and Piano. And he never said that this was explicitly the case, but it's very close. The balance is very close there. I mean, it is a delightful work, in fact, the Humours of Carolyn, which is, it's a pity it's not better known.
He did a lot of first performances with the Cork Symphony Orchestra of Fred May's work, I think, E.J. Moran, I think some Arnold Bax, but that was very difficult. They were, I think what he did with Bax was a friend of the family's. He used to come over every year for 25 years, I think, when my father was growing up. And in fact, he died in our house then in 1953. And I think it was 2 days before Bax died, he gave a concert, a whole Bax evening in the Phoenix Hall with the left-hand piano concerto played by Harriet Cohen and The Gardens of Fand, which was one of Bax's own favourite works. And that was the last time Bax heard his music.
We had a very impressive series of external examiners. Sir Richard Terry was my first. Sir Granville Bantock, charming old fellow, was the second. Then we had Sir Arnold Bax. He lived in our house for the summer of nearly 30 years in succession. He was a very close friend. And then the composer E.J. Moran was another. We knew Herbert Hughes fairly intimately. One of the people who ran a big house in Foynes, County Limerick, was Lord Monteagle, who had an organ in his drawing room and used to give the most marvellous evenings. So we had a very good time, very good general social life, I must say. And of course, Professor Lache in Dublin was a very good friend. We used to stay in this house quite a lot, and he used to run big parties for anybody visiting there.
Obviously, his personal friendship with Arnold Bax and E.J. Moran had an influence and coloured his view of it. I mean, in other words, he had a personal association with 20th century English music through the two of those. But you must remember that for a composer whose initial project was to create what he called a Gaelic art music, in other words, to found a style of music which would be Irish and at the same time take its place within the European art tradition, the achievement of the English Renaissance composers, like Vaughan Williams in particular, that was an inspiration. I mean, Vaughan Williams showed how you could base a style on folk music and 16th century polyphony, which is the Tudor polyphony that Vaughan Williams and his contemporaries looked back to, and yet at the same time how that style could completely transcend those influences as it became something new. And I think that must have been a big influence on Fleischmann's own career, especially as they were so near.
I've been accused of being influenced by Bax, but that isn't true, because before I came to know Bax's work at all, I had established a kind of a style to a certain extent based on Irish folk song and on the modal system. I wrote in a rather terse and rather austere style, fairly diatonic and not too esoteric.
Thank you.
shall we say, he was energetic and enthusiastic. And he had, it might seem that he was sort of Germanic, that he was Germanic, but he actually had a kind of an Irish touch as well. He was humorous now, in a gentle kind of way. He'd poke fun at you, but not in an offensive kind of way. Now, he would have been, you know, he'd get the message across without having to be, he'd never insult anyone, you know, and he was very patient, but he was also straight and to the point, and he got things done.
I remember once Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears came over and stayed in the house, and my father had, I think, borrowed an old car from his wife's uncle, an old Model T Ford, but the battery wasn't too good and it wouldn't start. So Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears pushed it up the lane, no problem, and they got it going. They were all very modest people, I think, and didn't mind a bit of a rather battered house, which our beautiful Glen was. It was wonderfully romantic. But my mother didn't believe too much in the art of housekeeping. She thought it was a horrible job for a woman, that it was only noticed when it wasn't done. So, but it was full of interesting books and beautiful pictures, and most people who came were fascinated by it and didn't quite realise perhaps the discomforts of living there, in the winter especially, and there was no central heating, of course.
And then he had to cope with children and things that the ordinary man on the street has no idea how much domesticated he has become. And he will at Dappy go climbing cliffs with them when they were small, places they shouldn't be left going to at all. He wasn't the very best guide for small children. This was a difficult cliff and he'd go down it and he's sure they'd all probably get there. And if they didn't, he'd do something, you know. And the places where I wouldn't have allowed them go at all was eventually where you would find he had brought them down the week before. There's a lot of the schoolboy in him still. Adventurous. Going difficult places and things that can't be done. Difficulties are only there to be overcome.
He took a great interest in the face of the country, and apart from the fact that he was trying to get music into schools, which meant a lot of political involvement at the department level, he caused some, not too much worry to my mother when he suggested that the staff of UCC in the 80s, which was a terrible time, shocking emigration and depression and no jobs for anybody and no prospect of any improvement. And Dad thought that it would be the proper thing for the academic staff of the university to make a good example and to take a 10% cut on their salaries. So he put this to an academic council meeting, and if you can imagine the impact it had. My mother was not too worried because she knew how the others would react, but she thought it was typical of the poor fool.
Day or night. I think he has about 6 hours sleep and the rest of the day's flat out following up all his bits and pieces. I don't think he has time to grow old. His mind hasn't grown old anyway. He does a certain amount of gardening, because I don't. And if he didn't do it, it would be just chaos. So he keeps the garden in condition, cuts grass and all these sort of things. He also cuts wood if he's put to it. But if he's really enjoying himself, he's climbing a mountain. If he sits down for 2 minutes, he drops off asleep. He has that same capacity that his father had of having, I think they call them cat naps, a quarter an hour, half an hour, on any moment when he's not actually occupied with something else. He'll go out like a light, even in the middle of a party. There was a ballet of Michael McLemore's that he wanted Alice to put music to. And when the business of that was discussed, the evening was going on, and Michael was telling one of his better stories about Lady Gregory. And I had known the story because I heard it 2 days beforehand, and I knew that it took 20 minutes. And I watched Michael building himself up. I watched Alois's eyes, you know, just going off to sleep. He was fast asleep. And Michael, the true actor, wasn't going to be defeated. He built that story up and up and up. But he didn't. He had to finish it before Alois woke up, because 20 minutes was the amount of time that he spent. We'll be right back.
Fleischmann was commissioned in 1944 to write a piece for the celebrations of the Four Masters, which he produced an overture of that name, which was very well received and, in fact, one of his finest works at this period. And the following year, he was commissioned by the government of Ireland to write a piece for the Thomas Davis centenary. And that's how Clary's Dragoons came about. The idea, interestingly, of including a part for the war pipes, it actually works extremely well in the score. The whole nature of the poem and everything suits the instrument. I mean, it's a brilliant conception, especially since the inclusion of the war pipes is actually built into the score in a very theatrical way, because the first time the pipes are heard, it's off stage, so there's a climax in the orchestra and there's a sudden cessation of this violent music, and off in the distance, out of sight, you hear the pipes playing. So it's quite an effective device. So you don't see the piper at all at this stage. But at the end of the piece, when the final return of the principal tune, the Clary's Dragoons tune, comes back, the piper enters the auditorium and marches up through the auditorium and rises onto the stage to conclude the piece with the performers. And it has always, any time I've heard it performed, and Fleischmann always said the same thing, it always brings the house down.
That you're here tonight. So would you please welcome Professor John A. Murphy.
And Clary's Dragoons, performed in 1945, the Barra says that it belongs to the kind of heroic and optimistic aspect of Irish nationalism. And indeed, in 1945, the belief or the acceptance of people like Alice Fleischmann and myself, then a first-year student, to the principles of Irish nationalism was unquestioning and uncomplicated. And so, as well as commemorating one of the great philosophers of Irish nationalism, Alice Fleischmann was also celebrating, if you like, that contemporary time, that contemporary achievement. Raise my voice in a work which was claimed would have seen the London Proms were it not feared that it would give offence to an English audience. But I didn't really mind that in that stage. It was a cultural alibi for my juvenile anglophobia. The brave old lord died near the fight, but for each drop he lost that night, a Saxon cavalier shall bite the dust before Lord Clary's Dragoon.
Memory of him is that he was always very cheerful and took a great zest in conducting and in doing new programs. Was always very worried lest it should be a disaster, and he always knew that it could easily be, and that nothing but the hugest effort
would perhaps prevent that happening. So it wasn't any sort of sense of false alarm when he would come back after rehearsal and say, "How did it go, Dad?" I'd say, "Oh, hopeless, quite hopeless." And Mother would just throw her eyes up to heaven because she knew it always worked out in the end, but he wasn't sure it would.
When Joan Denise Moriarty played the pipes for Clara's Dragoons in 1945, apparently she made a bargain with Fleischmann that she would agree to do this if he put the Cork Symphony Orchestra at her disposal and played for her ballet. She was hoping to put on a ballet production. So they did this for one night as an experiment in 1947, and this was so well received and so successful that the following year, 1948, they decided to mount a week of ballet in Cork, and it was for that week that he wrote his first ballet score, which was The Golden Bell of Co. And he did write a number of other ballets for them. In 1951, he wrote a ballet to a scenario by Micheál MacLiomore called An Coachín Dearg, The Red Petticoat. And in 1955, he wrote a ballet. I think the scenario was written by himself and Joan Denise Moriarty on the legend of Macharua. But it was essentially 10 years of that period from 1947 to 1957 that most of the important works he wrote were for ballet. And of course, the last score, one of his last scores after he retired from the chair of music in UCC, was The Thoin, which was a full-length evenings of ballet, which was a huge score for him to produce, and that was his last ballet score, and that was also for Joan Denise Moriarty.
If you look at what he has done, just one man, what he accomplished almost alone. I know he didn't work alone, now he galvanised other people to do things. Like even where Joan Denise Moriarty was concerned now, the ballet company, people said it couldn't succeed and they really started from scratch. And it just goes to show what you can do even with no resources if you have the determination. He got people behind him and he was charming, you know, in his own way, even though he was always rushing around, but he had a sense of humour and a sense of balance and determination, and when you add all those in with talent, you know, it amounts to an awful lot really.
Very pleased that the Arts Council was set up, had of course then certain disagreements with them over policy of, he felt that they should do a lot more for the regions than they did. But he had one great ability, which was that he might perhaps disagree with the policies that individuals or their institutions were pursuing very vociferously, but he always distinguished between the policy being advocated and the person doing the advocation. And he always managed to keep the relations with the person very, very friendly and cordial while totally disagreeing with what they were doing. And that, I think, was a very valuable ability to make him successful in keeping good relations with people and making it very much harder for them to say no.
Yes, it was started in connection with An Tostal, when every small place was encouraged to develop a festival. And I remember being asked by the organizer of An Tostal whether we should take a choral festival or a folk dance festival. I said preferably both, but if we have to have one or the other, we better let us take a choral festival. And subsequently, the people who were asked to take on the folk dance festival were unable to do so, and we took on both. That's how it started in 1954. And it began a very small way, but it has grown out of all proportion now.
Opening on the 30th with them. We've told a lot of people that.
Well, are you booked out on the opening night?
On the opening night for the balcony, I have nothing at all left.
And what about Thursday, Friday? You've some, have you?
I have some, yeah. But we have plenty of course for the stalls on those nights. But, Oh, yes.
Well, towards the end of the week, will you have
it? Yes, I'll pass that on to him. Okay, thank you.
His work then with the Choral Festival is also legendary. Vivian Ryan was on the administration side of things for the Choral Festival.
As I say, I was the only paid employee, and, you know, the bulk of the year was pretty quiet, all right, but at festival time then it became the opposite, absolutely hectic. And the committees moved in full, and we'd always get one or two, maybe a girl to do the switchboard, somebody to sell tickets, that kind of thing. It kind of changed completely for about 6 weeks. My brief was everything, letters, all kinds of correspondence with the choirs, book the city hall, and you had music committee meetings during the year to pick the music for the next one and discuss it and decide, because they were what they call set pieces that choirs had to sing, and then they had a choice of their own. I think it's slightly different now. So you had all that.
We had never heard singing like that. My grandfather's choir in the cathedral were the only people that we had heard singing, and it was church music, and it was special. And the excitement, I remember an Italian choir came. People were electrified at the beauty of the music they produced. We had lots of Welsh minor choirs. In those days, there was also a whole pile of contacts with the Eastern countries. They had no hard currency at all, so they were put up by Cork families, and apparently the links and the friendships were amazing. And we had choirs coming down from Northern Ireland at a time when there was virtually no contact at all. And they were Orange choirs, one of them, Portadown, I think, was one of them, and they still come. And they used to get rousing welcomes once they came down with a lambeg drum and, you know, gave a few wallops to show what it could be like, and brought the house down.
It was early in the days when they were actually getting Eastern European choirs, and I remember there was one from Poland that year, little thinking there'd be so many Polish collections here later. We had a Bulgarian choir. I can't remember now, but every year there were 3, 4, 5 from the what we used to call behind the Iron Curtain. And that was a tricky situation because they weren't, you know, they were watched like hawks and they weren't allowed to go to the festival club or anything like that. They didn't have money. So two members of the committee set up this scheme of getting in touch with citizens to have them put them up. People were marvellous. I mean, they'd put up upwards of 100 people every year. But I think a lot of them, not only were they interested in music, but they were the type who liked meeting people, you know. And there again, it was far more unusual to have all foreigners like that around. And then you'd have English choirs, you'd have ordinary continental choirs, you'd have a few American choirs, Canadian, Swedish over the years, you know. Jump, bum, jump, bum, jump, bum, jump.
So it was a bridge building exercise, I think, at a time when that sort of bridge was quite unusual. And now it has, of course, become absolutely commonplace to go off to all sorts of exotic countries. But in those days it wasn't, and it gave Cork wonderful colour and a sense of. It established contacts with Europe, which were, in fact, they were anticipating the economic ties that were to come 10 or 20 years later, in fact. So it was very exciting indeed, yes.
Always begging and begging for money. Our main sponsors for years were Bord Foilton. And then they handed us over to the Arts Council. We thought we were made, but in actual fact, they weren't as good as Bord Foilton at all for supporting us. And in the end, they actually closed it down. They said they hadn't the money to support it. So, I mean, that was deeply ironic, I thought. You know, you'd think the Arts Council would be the greatest support you could have.
The greatest headache is the folk dance groups, because they're always uncertain until the last minute. If they all come, it's a financial disaster. If they don't come, it's an artistic disaster. And they're trying to keep the balance between the two.
We had a dreadful time one year. I thought my hour had come. You see, the last competition ran right up to late Sunday afternoon. So then they'd come with the results. And we would have had the sheets typed ready, but you had to insert the results then. So one year we were all up on stage at the end anyway in our glittering finery. For the main competitions, the adjudicators who actually were judged those would get up and announce themselves. Can't remember which competition, but one of the big ones. And he announced the wrong people as being the winners. I went cold because I said, God almighty, have I typed the wrong thing, you know? But 'twas he himself had misread his own notes, thank God. But there was all consternation, and the choir who should have won, they were baying around the platform once it was over, and people in tears and flashing eyes and red faces and, you know, accusations and so on. And then the people who were announced as having won were upset as well. And you are competitive and you do want to do your best, and then to win and have it snatched from you is upsetting.
In Bulgaria now, for instance, there are over 10,000 choirs. Every factory, every institution has its choir, and they have competitive festivals starting in the regions and then working towards the capital, so that you get choirs of the very first order at the top.
Throughout the year he'd only come in about 20 minutes a day just to sign what had to be signed and discuss what had to be done next. Well, he was very with it, yeah. Absent-minded now. Just your typical absent-minded professor, really. Of course, the reason for that is he had so many things in his plate. He had his own job. He had us, he had the Orchestral Society, the Cork Symphony Orchestra as it was then, and he was connected to the Ballet Company on the board of that. So he had 100 fingers in 100 pies, you know.
Well, it's for speed he uses it. And he's far too old, to be honest. But I was talking to him yesterday about the car in which we should... I mean, there ought to be some organisation as to what hours anybody had it. And he said, why? I'd be on it for the next 15 years. So I said, don't you realise you'd be 85? What about it? Where does that leave you?
His voice, his being, literally his soul, is extremely important to the understanding of the Irish psyche. It's as important as O'Riordan in a very, very different way. It's important not just on the level of composition, but also amazingly on the level of music education, the history of music education, and the selfless dedication that the man had of spreading music throughout the university system. Throughout the entire education system, first, second level, third level, mainly second level, because he was training potential music teachers.
When I started writing music 30 years ago, the folk song revival was in full swing. Some of the most active composers could indeed do little more than add three fraternal parts beneath a tune, and even this harmless activity led to much controversy and mutual slating. But new ideas were in the air, and it seemed vital at that time to delve into the hidden Ireland, and out of the folk song, out of the heroic tales and romances of Diarmuid and Groine and of Sweeney Gelt, out of the panegyrics and creeners of Eoghan O'Rahilly, to create an idiom which would express in music some of the essence of this rich, untapped literary tradition. Thank you.
part of the overture The Four Masters by Alois Fleischmann, played by the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Houlihan. Contributors to the programme included Alois, Anne and Ruth Fleischmann, Seamus de Barra, Michal O'Sullivan, Kitty Buckley, Professor John A. Murphy and Vivian Ryan. The producer is Celia Donoghue.